One more time, let me say, there are no miraculous signs in the sky before the Great Tribulation. So don't, when people say, well, there's a blood moon, two blood moons, all this. Another thing to remember is that if it's predictable, it's not a supernatural sign. Now, when the man in the moon eclipses his own hair, that's...
The moon that's made up of gas?
Yeah, as one of our esteemed politicians pointed out, the moon is made out of gas.
Yeah, I heard that.
Very helpful.
Jesus.
Okay. This is study number 15 of the book of Mark, and the theme of the book of Mark is expressed by Jesus himself in Mark 10:45, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life in exchange for the many. Jesus is the ultimate servant, and he gave his life. And remember, he gave his life has a double meaning. When we say someone gave his life, sometimes we just mean means he died. He gave his life. And he certainly did. And that means that when he died, he paid the penalty of eternal separation that we should have paid. So he died for us. But it also means literally he gave us his life. He lived a totally perfect life. But he was willing to take that account off of his book and put it onto ours. So he gave us his perfect life. In exchange for everybody? No. The many. What that means is that his death, which he came as our substitute, he identified with us, he became our substitute. That's only available for people who accept the gift. People who one time in their lives say, I have sinned, that sin has separated me from you, God. I have no way to close that gap. I can't do enough good works to compensate, but I'm trusting that your son, Jesus, took my identity and died in my place in exchange for me. In exchange for me. Mark presents Jesus as a servant, mostly through stories. We saw last couple of times that occasionally Mark will show up, or Mark will reveal a parable Jesus gave. But even his parables are stories. But mostly, well, by the way, the reason he started teaching in parables was that he at first was teaching openly. He was saying, the kingdom is coming, I'm your Messiah. He gave the gospel. All that was doing was causing hostility among the Pharisees and the Herodians in the government. So he switched to parables that had kind of a hidden meaning so that people who were hostile would not understand what he was talking about, but people who wanted to understand, he would explain it to them. It's a brilliant maneuver, sort of like talking in code. So last week we saw some of the parables, and now we go back to stories. We've seen a pattern in his stories. His stories are very brief, they're quick, they're short stories, and we're tempted to say, okay, it's a great story, and just move on to the next. But we've also been seeing that every one of these stories is charged with meaning. And what we have to do is look for details, look for keywords, expressions, and these stories become vivid to us because Peter was telling Mark these stories. And he was using the present tense. And unfortunately, in our translations, they rendered them as past tenses. So when we read the stories, it's like, Jesus did this, and Jesus did that, and Jesus did this. Whereas if we changed it to what it originally said, it was things like, and Jesus goes into this house, and they let this guy down, and the crowd looks up, and Jesus says, hey, look at this guy. See, that's a lot more vivid to say. And furthermore, they brought people down from the roof. We've also been seeing every one of these stories, if we really think about it, there's tension and there's drama. in every one of these stories. Now, what's intriguing about the story we're going to see today, and it's a very famous story, the story of Jesus in the boat when the storm and he goes to sleep. We all know the story, don't we? We all know basically the story. You're in a boat, storm comes, Jesus is asleep, disciples, hey, what's going on? He says, be still, and the boat was calm. That's pretty much the story. We think, what a great story. Jesus can make the storm stop, and let's move on to the next story. We do that, we're missing out. You know, there are some real mysteries in this story beyond the surface. One thing I want to point out is that obviously we understand why there was tension and there was drama. You know that the tension and drama starts at the very beginning. The tension and drama starts even before the storm. And it starts with Mark 4:35. On that day, the same day Jesus was teaching the parables. It had been a long day. He was exhausted. On that day, when evening came, and again, here's the present tense, he tells them, let's go over to the other side. Isn't that been saying? He explained to them, this is Peter telling Mark. He tells us, let's go to the other side. The other side of what? The other side of the Sea of Galilee. Called a Sea of Galilee, it's really a lake. But it's big and it has certain features of a sea. Now, the original readers of this gospel, or let's say the listeners, as well as the disciples, whenever Jesus said, let's go over to the other side, the tension and drama has already started. Just saying, let's go over to the other side. The disciples heard that, they were tense. Original readers read that, they're tense. I'll tell you why here. But leaving the crowd, they took him along with them in the boat. A few weeks earlier, he had been in a boat in the Sea of Galilee for a different reason. Remember, there was a plot to kill him, to infiltrate the crowds following him, stab him. So Jesus got into a little boat there to protect himself from the crowd. I think he sort of liked that. So this time they got a much bigger boat. Leaving the crowd, they take him along with them in the boat. Remember, they're already tense because he said, let's go to the other side. Verse 37, and there arises a fierce gale of wind, and the waves are breaking over the boat so much the boat is already filling up. Jesus himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. See, he was exhausted. And they woke him and said to him, teacher, do you not care that we're perishing? Here's a little pet peeve of mine. NASB, NIV, they all claim that they translated from the original documents. They didn't. I know what they did. They took the King James and they took some of the modern manuscripts and kind of cross-checked. The reason I say that is that who says perishing? You wouldn't know when to say, we're perishing. You say, I'm dying. Anyway, I don't feel like changing every word, but they wouldn't have said we're perishing. They would have said, we're dying. We're dying here. And here's Peter now telling the story in the presence, and he gets up. And he rebukes the wind and says to the sea, muzzle yourself. That's like saying, shut up. It's interesting, that's exactly what he told a demon his first day of miracle working at Capernaum. Muzzle yourself. Shut up. He what?
The demon was proclaiming him as God.
Yeah, it's interesting. The demon said, the demon told the truth. You're the Son of the Most High God. Jesus, shut up. It just amazes me. Jesus was impolite sometimes. And here's Peter. And the wind dies down and it's perfectly calm. Can you hear Peter saying this? Can you believe this? All of a sudden the wind stops. It's calm. And he says, Jesus says, why are you afraid? Good thing I wasn't there. I would have gone, well, duh. Why are you afraid? And it's translated, do you still have no faith? It didn't, not really what he said. He said, is that you are lacking in faith? Now, isn't that an odd thing for him to say? I know it's easy for us looking back to say, well, they should have had faith. Did he really expect them to not be afraid? Think about that. Water spilling into the boat, a huge wind. By the way, those winds on the Sea of Galilee to this day can get up to 150 miles an hour. The boat's filling up with water, and he says, why were you afraid? Okay, let's not be super spiritual here. Of course they were afraid. And my question is, did he really, really expect them to not be afraid? Something to think about. Now, what's really funny, they're afraid when the storm comes. Now, all of a sudden, it stops because he told the wind to shut up, and it worked. Now, all of a sudden, the sea is perfectly calm, and now they're afraid again. They were afraid of the storm, now they're afraid. And it's just one of those, it's one of those fears that would be hard to pinpoint why. It's just that something bizarre has happened. And the fact that all of a sudden everything went calm, that scared them even more.
It looked like they were in shock.
I would say they probably were in shock.
John, at this time, would you say they actually knew who he was? They call him teacher, they're afraid they're going to drown?
They sure don't know that he's the Son of God. Absolutely do not know that. They may not. They may know he's the Messiah. I'm not 100% sure about that. Bare minimum, they knew he was a prophet. They knew that. But the fact they called him teacher means they certainly don't have any idea who he is. But now they're struck with fear. And I'm going to get back to that in a minute, because they were struck with fear is a phrase that appears frequently throughout the book of Mark. And it's tied to the end of the book of Mark. There's a controversy about the end of the book of Mark, and I'll show how this passage explains it. Book of Mark ends in a very odd way, but I'll get to that. So, those are the highlights. You see already we have some tension and drama here before it starts, at the very beginning. Let's back up. On that day when evening came, he tells them, let's go over to the other side. And again, the disciples and everybody hearing this story for the first time, you know, people, a lot of people didn't read then. So people reading this or people listening to it, as soon as they hear, let's go to the other side, well, uh-oh, they're already experiencing tension and drama right then. Because let's go over to the other side meant the east side of the Sea of Galilee. This is like east side, west side. Now the west side, they're very familiar with. That's where the cities were, Capernaum, Tiberias, Bethsaida. Matter of fact, it was one long string of populated area on the west side of Galilee, and it was sophisticated, civilized culture, heavily influenced by Judaism and by the Roman Empire strength. Go across the Sea of Galilee to the east side, and all of a sudden you're in a pagan territory, unknown. In fact, people said that's where Satan lives. And we'll see next time there was some demonic activity over there. So, let's go over to the other side. The disciples going, uh-oh.
We got the West Side story.
Yeah, how about West Side story? Let's just stay here.
Sorry.
Let's just stay here.
We just saw who's away.
So that was one reason that let's go to the other side would cause them distress, turmoil, tension. Another reason was the Sea of Galilee itself. Just crossing that sea itself. Sea of Galilee, very interesting. You know, it's the lowest freshwater lake in the world. It's about 700-800 feet below sea level. Water is very, very warm. And it's very big. It's like 15 miles north-south, 8 to 10 miles wide, east-west. And it's about 150 feet deep. It's a big hole, a big reservoir of hot water.
The Sea of Galilee was very cold.
Nope. Very warm.
Especially being that deep.
It's very warm because it's so low.
It's so close to the Earth's core.
Right. Yeah. As you what dig down, you know, geothermal heating, it can be 20 feet deep even. When you're 50 feet deep, or over 100 feet deep, it gets warm. Now you have this warm water. Mm-hmm. And just to the north of the Sea of Galilee is Mount Hermon, which almost always has snow on the top. Matter of fact, it provides the water for the Jordan River. Winds coming off Mount Hermon are cold. Now, what happens is, the winds come down from Mount Hermon and it's cold. It meets the warm water of the Sea of Galilee, and to this day, brutal storms develop. 10 to 15 feet waves. Entire ships have been swallowed up. And I mean in modern history. Storm comes up very quickly. There's no time to react. And all of a sudden, the ship is just down. See why they were afraid? They thought there was no hope. So let's go over to the other side. That sentence itself is full of tension and drama. Let's go the other side. But they get in the boat. Verse 36, they take him along with him in the boat. Fairly recently, I saw where archaeologists have uncovered in the mud on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee a ship that dated to about the time of Jesus. This must have been the ship, not the ship, the type of ship that Jesus and his disciples were in. It was about 30 feet long, about 8 to 10 feet wide, 5 foot deep, and it could easily hold 15 to 20 people. That would have been the kind of boat that they were in. And there arises a fierce gale of wind, no warning. Gale means a strong blast. The wind didn't pick up gradually, all of a sudden, wham. And that's, as I said, even today, that's what happens to the Sea of Galilee. Now, the only difference is today we're equipped to have weather predictions. So we know a few days out when that cold wind is going to kick up from Mount Hermon. And people don't go on that lake when that's happening, about to happen. They had nothing like that. And I guarantee you, as soon as that first blast of wind came from the north, they knew they were in trouble. Because there had been no time to get away from it. Now all of a sudden the waves kick up, they're breaking over the boat. And look at this, so that the boat is already filling up. That means immediately, just as the storm is starting, the boat is almost full. Jesus himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. I love this. It shows his humanity. He really became a human being because he was so exhausted he could sleep through that. Dale?
I don't know. Is there any significance to the cushion instead of a cushion?
I just think that, well, not that I know of. Apparently he only had one and he grabbed it. So he had dibs. I'm the Messiah, I got dibs on the cushion.
It's the holy cushion.
The holy cushion. I've heard of pillows of faith. And they woke up, they woke him, said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we're dying?" I'm actually not sure what to make of this. What were they trying to accomplish? I guarantee you they had no idea he could stop the storm. Never crossed their minds. So I'm not sure what they wanted from him. I guess just, well, don't be sleeping if we can't.
Yeah. I'm surprised the water didn't wake him up if it was splashing over the side.
Thought that.
Well, the boat that was excavated has a prominent area at the bow and at the stern that was elevated. So maybe he was above the water level. He gets up, rebukes the wind, and again, present tense here, here's Peter. He gets up. He yells out, "Shut up!" And now the wind dies down and it's perfectly calm. What?
Probably, now they're taking buckets and emptying water out of the boat.
I don't think they could even bucket the water out because they couldn't move. Wind's blowing the boat all around, it's filling up with water.
But that would be the normal thing, but they're in shock.
They are totally in shock. Yes. So, again, I'm not sure what they expected us to do. I'm not sure what they expected him to do. But let's think about the situation. Now there's a moment of silence. And again, you know what? That would be kind of scary. The storm comes up all of a sudden. That scares him. And then all of a sudden he says, "Shut up," and it stops. I guarantee you that would scare us. What just happened here? Am I in the Twilight Zone? So now they're scared for a second reason. They're scared when the storm starts, and now they're scared when it stops. They weren't expecting that. They're hoping it calmly, gradually dies down. They weren't expecting their teacher to stand up and tell the wind to shut up, and it does. Okay, who am I dealing with? So now they're afraid. And now Jesus asks this question. He has two questions. Verse 40, and he says, "Why are you afraid?" I'd say, well, that would be pretty easy for me to answer. But here's the problem. Or I'll say, here's the advantage of the Greek language. It has precision that we don't have. And I don't know how else to translate this. I just have to explain something. When we say, "Why are you doing something?" Think about a situation where you ask someone, "Why are you doing that?" There are three things we can mean. When we say, "Why are you doing that?" When you say the first thing we can mean is, "Why are you doing that? And I don't think you should." Right? Why are you doing that? Isn't there an implication they're doing something that you think they shouldn't do? That's the first meaning. But you know what? There can be another meaning when you say, "Why are you doing that?" And that in that case, there's no implication they're doing anything wrong. In fact, as far as you know, doing everything right, you just don't know. Why are you doing that? Just wanting to know.
What's your thinking?
Why are you doing that? What are you trying to accomplish? And really, again, no insinuation of anything wrong. In fact, when I've asked people that, I'm thinking they know and I don't. When I'm at a mechanic, whatever they say, I believe. If they say I need to put more water in my tires, I'd say, where do I go? I'm totally at their mercy. And if I happen to ask a question, I'm certainly not implying you're doing anything wrong. I really just don't know. Why are you doing that? You know, there's a third meaning of why are you doing that. And that is the opportunity for the other person to examine himself. So it would be easy to look at this, why are you afraid, and think he was rebuking them. He wasn't in the least. I mean, come on, he totally understood why they were afraid. He wasn't stupid. This terrific storm comes up, the boat's filling up with water, they can't navigate. Of course he knew why they were. Of course he expected them to be afraid. He did not expect them to not be afraid. He wasn't criticizing. Also, he wasn't trying to get to the mechanics of it because he knew. When he said, "Why are you afraid?" he was just saying, "Okay, guys, now that it's calm, the storm is over, let's think about something. I want all of us to examine, why was I afraid?" And the answer is more profound than it would seem. Again, if I were there, I would have said, "Well, duh." I would have said, "Jesus, is that a trick question? Why am I afraid?" And I would say something like, "The boat was filling with water." He would say, "Well, then why does that make you afraid?" "Well, because the boat would sink." "And why would that make you afraid?" "Because I would die." There we go. "That's why you were afraid." "And why would dying make you afraid?" See, if you keep on going, keep on asking yourself, "Why am I afraid? Why this? Why that?" It's a great exercise to do with ourselves. Ultimately, I would have to say, well, if you keep asking why this, why that, I would say, I guess I was afraid because I didn't realize somebody's in control of my life. And ultimately, that was their fear. They didn't understand that somebody was in control of their lives. They were acting as if this is a world without God. It's a world where random things happen. Everything is just a random collision of atoms and molecules. Then we should be afraid. And I think he was telling me, if God's in control of your life, then there's no reason to be afraid. So ultimately, he says, "Why are you afraid?" And I'm sure the question and answers go back, "Well, then why would that make you afraid?" Ultimately, it was like the answer was we were afraid we would die, and we would think that no one is in charge of my life. That's the ultimate source of fear. So Jesus, now the second question makes sense. Now, it doesn't say, "Do you still have no faith?" It'd been a terrible thing to say. He said, "Is it that you are lacking in faith?" See what he's doing? He's gently questioning. "Why are you afraid, guys?" "Well, because the boat was sinking." "Why'd that make you afraid?" "Well, hello, because we're in danger of dying." "And why does that make you afraid?" "Because I don't want to die." "Why do you not want to die?" "Oh, because I don't feel like anybody's controlling my life." So then he says, "So really, guys, ultimately you're afraid because you don't have faith." Not some kind of generic faith, but faith that God specifically is watching over you. And what's amazing about God is that He promises to protect everybody to some degree, even the unbeliever. There will be many people in hell who God protected and helped during their lifetime. For those of us who have trusted in Jesus as Savior, there's an absolute guarantee He's in control of every part of your life. And that's the point here. Is it that you are lacking in faith? Now that they've absorbed that, and again, I'll say again, they have a second round of fear. They've assimilated all this. What a miraculous thing just happened. And it's hard to put ourselves in that position, but I think we'd be afraid too. Not of the storm itself, but of the aftermath. If somebody, can you imagine if you're in a car with somebody, you see a tornado coming, the car starts whipping around. Somebody in the car says to the tornado, "Hey, shut up," and it stops. I think I'd say, "Get me out of this car." That would make you afraid. So now they're afraid for the second time. They were struck with fear and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Now, it's really interesting when he said, "Muzzle yourself, shut up." Because his first day of miracle working at Capernaum, the first demoniac that he encountered, the first demon he cast out. Well, let's look at it, Mark 1:24. The demonic person says, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus of Nazareth?" Why did he say that? Because demons believe that if you say somebody's name, you get control over them. And by the way, that does work in the demonic realm. If you happen to know a demon's name and you say his name, that will shut him up. So they're saying Jesus of Nazareth to cool him down didn't work. "Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, Holy One of God." Verse 25, Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Muzzle yourself, shut up." Same word as the same word as what he said in the boat to the storm. Now let's think about that. The same word he said, and by the way, that's a very unusual expression. If it said, "Hello, how are you?" it'd been one thing. But to say, "Shut up, muzzle yourself," to the demon and to the wind.
Was he talking to someone in particular?
Let's think about that. Why'd he use the same word? And why wouldn't he just say, "Peace, be still"? Why do you say, "Shut up"? Well, and questions like this, typical story of Mark. There's tension, there's drama. Mark always introduces an element of mystery. And whenever the mystery gets profound, we recognize that there's something bigger going on here than a storm on the Sea of Galilee. There's something much more important. And in a bigger sense, the story we just read has cosmic type implications. And in this story, what we have is a picture of the three enemies of the believer. Did you see them? In that story, we saw the three enemies of the believer. First, let's think about who the characters are in this story. First character is the Sea of Galilee itself. The second character are the winds. Third character are the disciples in the boat. And of course, Jesus. All of those are pictures. Pictures of the three enemies of the believer. What about the sea? You know that in the Bible, the sea always pictures the same thing. The same thing. In the Bible, the sea always is a picture of something. And that's why it's called the Sea of Galilee, because it's not really a sea, it's a lake. But it has characteristics of seas, and especially in the spiritual realm. In the Bible, sea is always a picture of the human race. Specifically, the fallen human race. Revelation 13:1, "And the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. Then I saw a beast," this is the Apostle John speaking, "this beast is the Antichrist, coming up out of the sea." He's a human being. He rises from humanity. "Having 10 horns and 7 heads." That's the government of the revived Roman Empire. "On his horns were 10 crowns. On his heads were blasphemous names." Verse 11, "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth." This is the false prophet who will present himself as the Messiah. Where does he come from? Out of the earth. So the sea, and there are many passages like this, the sea is a picture of the fallen human race. So, three enemies of the believer. One is the world. The world system. There's two more enemies of the believer. Ephesians 2:1. "And you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked, according to the course of this world, there we go, there's our enemy, according to the prince of the power of the air." There's a second enemy of the believer, Satan. Who's the third enemy of the believer? "Among them, we too all formerly lived in the lusts," that's too strong, just the desires, "of our flesh." There's the three enemies right there. The world, Satan, and our flesh. And when I say our flesh, I don't mean evil. I mean ourself. And many times it's manifested as trying to do good, trying to do what's right in our own strength. That's our flesh, and that's our enemy. So what about these three enemies? Well, Satan, is he really a threat to us? He shouldn't be, because he's already been conquered. Colossians 2:15, "When he," that's Jesus after the resurrection, "he disarmed the rulers and authorities," those are high-ranking demons, He made a public display of them, having triumphed over them through him. So Satan was defeated at the cross. Satan has no direct power over us. What about the world? That's the second enemy. Jesus addresses that in the upper room in John 16:33. These things I have spoken to you, so that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation. There's that Sea of Galilee, Storm. But take courage. I have overcome the world. So it's really amazing. Three enemies of the believer. One is Satan. One is the world. It's been conquered. Second is Satan. He's been conquered. What about our flesh? And there's a problem. Our flesh is still fallen. World is conquered. Satan's conquered, not our flesh. And Satan has no direct power over us, but he takes advantage. He can't control us. He can't throw thoughts into our mind. But he certainly can work in the world, send winds of adversity in our path. He can certainly do that. He cannot throw thoughts into our mind. He cannot do that. But he can certainly throw thoughts into the mind of the unbeliever. And he can certainly put them in our path. And he can certainly make storms. I believe he can impact the weather. He can. So you see, Satan cannot control us directly. He's been conquered. The world's been conquered. But he can present the world. You know what he can do? He can do two things with the world. He can make bad things happen in the world, or he can make the world a good place so that we will be tempted to get our needs met in the world.
He can control the wind because he's prince of the power of the air.
He's a prince of the power of the air. Yeah, that's where I think he gets the weather. And I put some verses here in the book of Job. Job 1:12, God said to Satan, look, he's talking about Job. Everything he has is in your power. Just don't put your hand on him. So that means whatever happens next to Job, Satan did it. So verse 15, the Sabaeans attacked and took their livestock. They killed the servants. Verse 16, fire from heaven came down. That's lightning. Verse 19, behold, a great wind came and struck the four corners of the house. You think it's an accident that God said, do whatever you can do, and all of a sudden the weather changes? Now I want to say very quickly something very fortunate. Satan's a prince of the power of the air, and he can do things with the weather. But he's not over the weather, ultimately. Psalm 135:5, for I know the Lord is great, and that our Lord is above all gods. Whatever the Lord pleases, he does. Here we go, in heaven and in earth, in the seas and in the deep. He makes vapor to ascend from the ends of the earth. Condensation, evaporation for rain. Who makes lightning for the rain and brings forth the wind from his treasuries? Ultimately, God's in control of the weather. And that means that, yes, Satan can manipulate things in this world to our adversity. He can make winds of adversity come, but God's in control, and he's not going to let it kill us. And that's what Jesus wanted to make the point with his disciples. A couple more loose ends. There's a lot of controversy about the end of the book of Mark. The oldest manuscripts end in an odd way. They went out, this is after the resurrection. They went out and fled from the tomb, for the trembling and astonishment had gripped them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were struck with fear, seeing that empty tomb. And then there are some bogus endings after this, of people going out and being baptized, people handling snakes, people drinking poison. All bogus. All those endings are bogus. Now, it's obvious why they didn't want to end it that way. They thought, did Mark really end his book with they were struck with fear? Answer is absolutely yes. It's the perfect ending for the book of Mark. Look back at our passage today. They were struck with fear and said to one another, who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? Many times in the book of Mark, we have this sentence, they were struck with fear. And the response is, who is this man? So you see, Mark, he doesn't draw conclusions for us. Mark lets us draw our own conclusions. So time after time, get the pattern? People are struck with fear, and they say, who is this man? They're struck with fear. Who is this? Struck with fear. Who is this? Mark ends, they were struck with fear. What's the obvious? We're the ones to say, well, then who is this? Anyway, that's just an aside. But, you know, when he said, does it boil down to a lack of faith? And what he specifically meant was, not that God would make us stronger, but that we would have his faith. As we've seen many times, we don't grow by improvement, we grow by replacement. And instead of saying, well, God's going to make me strong, we say, God's going to give me his strength. And in every circumstance of our life, we say, I'm afraid of this, give it to him. I'm going to give you my fear, you give me your faith. What's really amazing is that it's manifested in our lives as improvement. And we feel like we're getting stronger. We feel like we're getting more faith. And that's the way it's manifested, but that's not really what's happening. We're not improving. The flesh doesn't improve. Flesh never gets stronger. The flesh never gets better. We will replace our flesh with him. Give you an example. 2 weeks ago, my car, I couldn't shift. It wouldn't shift. Now it shifts just fine. But you know it wasn't improved? Now it was manifested as improvement. I couldn't shift 2 weeks ago. Now I can. That's how it's manifested to me, but that's not what really happened. They didn't improve that transmission. They replaced it. The old transmission was beyond repair. Our flesh is beyond repair. We're not going to get more stronger. We're not going to have more faith. We're not going to learn how to do something. We say, every situation in my life, okay, I'm going to give you my fear in this situation, and I'm counting you to give me your faith. See the difference? We always talk about getting the oil changed. Last time I took it in, I had this funny feeling. The guy said, you want us to change your oil? I said, no, I want you to replace it. I thought, they don't really change oil. They drain out the oil and put new oil in. I thought, that's how we, quote, grow. Not improvement, by replacement. A little bit at a time, I give you my fear in this situation. I expect you to give me your faith, your strength in this situation. See, that's what it means, in exchange for the many. It's always an exchange. I give him my fear, he gives me faith. And see, we always talk about give him your best. No, don't give him your best, give him your worst. He didn't want to get your best. Our best is pathetic, for one thing. Give him your worst. Doesn't that make more sense? Give him your worst. That's what he wants. He's our servant. Well, when he said, let's go to the other side, I guarantee you, as soon as he said that, they were afraid. Now, when they get to the other side, we're going to see what they were talking about, because it is wacko world on the other side. Anyway, Terry? Yeah. All of them had
described who the Messiah was going to be.
I can find very few of them who had a full understanding of who the Messiah was. Maybe the priest who was there at the when Elizabeth, John the Baptist's mother, came in, that priest who was there, the priest who saw the baby Jesus, maybe they understood, but they died. Yeah. I think during his lifetime, most people thought he would be the ultimate prophet. I can't find where anybody knew he was God. And in a way, he sort of shielded that because he kept calling himself the Son of Man. Now, there were zealots who thought he was going to come and conquer Rome. And they didn't even, I think they fully didn't understand that he was a prophet. I think they, some people thought, like the zealots, they thought he was just a military leader who would overthrow Rome. That's what the Pharisees thought at the beginning. So to answer your question, very few of them, I think none of them had an understanding that he was fully God. And that's why they were afraid.
John the Baptist, to your point, sent a messenger to him and asked him, "Are you the Messiah?" I think he asked.
John the Baptist didn't understand. John the Baptist sent him a message saying, "Are you the one who are to come, or are we to look for another?" You know what's interesting about that? When he said, "Are you the one who are to come, or are we to look for another?" The word "another" did not mean another instead of you. The word John the Baptist used was, "Are we to look for you and another," meaning another one like you. So he was saying, are there two messiahs? One's going to die and one's going to conquer. Even John the Baptist didn't fully get it.
What was Jesus' response?
He said, look at the prophecies made. Look at the predictions made in the book of Isaiah. Compare them with what I'm doing.
The blind walk.
The lame are walking. The blind are seeing.
Even though I had read the New Testament of the Gospels and heard it in the apostate church, you know, about Jesus being the Son of God, I didn't fully understand that he was God. And I didn't understand he had existed from eternity past.
Mm-hmm.
I knew none of that.
Yep. So they certainly would not have.
And until this study, I think, you know, I had never really thought about the preciseness of him wanting to reveal himself to humanity, because it was like Satan had his plan of revealing him too early in the wrong crowd or whatever it was, but it was so precise how Jesus wanted to reveal himself to us so that we would know he's God, he's not Satan, he's not part of that, you know?
Exactly.
I just had not ever thought of that.
And that's why I wanted to make it clear that in this passage, he did not expect them to think that he could get up and tell the storm to shut up. And so when we see the question, "Why are you afraid?" it makes it look like he's somewhat criticizing them, when there's no way they could have been expected to understand that he could tell the wind to shut up. I mean, don't get me wrong, I tell the wind to shut up all the time. It just doesn't do what I say. John?
So none of the people, disciples in the boat, were saved?
That's a good question. John said, were the disciples in the boat saved? I have to say, yes, they were. They were saved in the Old Testament sense. They were Old Testament saints. They were saved the same way David was and the others. They weren't fully New Testament saints yet. In fact, that didn't happen until Pentecost. Catherine?
Someone recently was saying that history isn't like just a thing. It's a series of events that people are responding to the best way they know how, but they don't know how it's going to work out. So when you look at these stories, like we're going through them, and you see them, this is the event that's happening, and the disciples really didn't know what was going to happen.
Right.
You know, we look at it, we go, yeah, he's going to come.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And we see it as a package, but they're step by step doing just what is natural to them at the time.
And Jesus appropriately teaching them based on the circumstances that happened. And he was a very good ad lib teacher, because Jesus did not know that storm was coming. I guarantee you. He was not omniscient. And if he had known the storm was coming, I don't believe he would have gone. But you know, there's something very encouraging. "Let's go to the other side." It was ominous for them, made them afraid. Those are the most reassuring words we can possibly hear. Because whenever what we're facing, he says, "Look to the other side." If you're dreading Tuesday, look forward to Wednesday. Let's go the other side. You're going to arrive at your destination. But from his perspective as a human being, I have to say he did not know the storm was coming. He would not have subjected them to that for that on purpose. Jeff.
I was always wondering, like, when he'd give these things, like, he went the first week and said, I'm God, everybody, and this is
He had to back off, and that's why he started doing the parables. When he started saying, you know, he forced the issue at the first day at Capernaum when he said, I can forgive sin, stand up and walk. Well, he backed off of that approach. Mm-hmm. I think he was feeling the Pharisees out, but he sure dropped that technique. Father, we thank you for this story, and once again, we thank you for these beautiful little mysterious stories that you have given your servant Mark. Thank you for Peter, who transcribed them. Above all, we thank you for Holy Spirit, who wrote these words ultimately and who makes them clear to us. We thank you for Jesus, whose death on the cross enabled us to have Holy Spirit to give us counsel and guidance. We thank you. We thank you for his sacrificial, substitutionary death on my behalf, and we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Email address on there.
Well, that was good.
I have to look it up.
Yeah.
My sciatic is bothering me this week.